This is a podcast from meow.net.
Meow!
As a social practice artist, I sometimes visit schools and lead creative activities for children. Teachers tell the class they must be good listeners. But what is a good listener? Am I a good listener? Listening can be hard to describe or define. It depends on your relationships, your context, your intentions for listening. I'd like my community-based art practice to be open and collaborative, and so surely listening is very important. My name is Hannah Kemp Welsh, and this series is part of my research into listening within social art practice. In these episodes, I speak to socially engaged, community and participatory artists to understand how they listen within their practice, what gets in the way of listening, and what the consequences of listening might be. Episode 7, Sylvan Baker, Changing the Resonance. Sylvan was introduced to me by my PhD supervisor, and quite aside from his inspiring work, I was struck by his warm and generous spirit. Prior to his current role as senior lecturer at the Central School of Speech and Drama, Sylvan worked across applied theatre, socially engaged arts, and education for 30 years, and his achievements, which include coordinating international partnerships between communities and arts organisations, are just too numerous to recount. He's deeply committed to inclusive practices that value lived experience. Could you kick us off, please, by just saying a little bit about your field of work?
Sure, yeah. I'm a senior lecturer in community performance and applied theatre at the Royal Central School of Speech and Drama. Prior to becoming a sort of a more academic practice and socially engaged researcher, I had my own practice in applied theatre and socially engaged practice for just over 30 years in various places.
Thank you. So applied theatre and socially engaged art, could you say more about that? What did it look like? Who did you work with?
So around our verbatim practices, we use the subvariant of verbatim, which is like, you know, recorded delivery, headphone verbatim. We record it testimony to like smart devices, and then we play the testimony to ourselves through headphones so that no one else hears the giver of the testimony. They're anonymous. And the performer, which is a weird term because you're not performing, you're kind of relaying it, I guess, says what they can hear. So the young people with us and some adults and young people will work together in small groups, interview each other, listen back to what's come up in the interviews, and then between the interviewer and the interviewee, choose a sound bite that can be anywhere up to, I don't know, 2 minutes worth of material that they then bring back to the big group to say this is part of what we were talking about. Sometimes that share back will then elicit more material in a big group discussion, which is also sometimes audio recorded. It also allows a bigger group of, say, 15 or 16 participants to then go, I think you should use that bit and that bit and that bit because they're really powerful. And in listening back, all kinds of things happen for the young people. It allows them to have a different relationship with their own history, particularly in care. It allows them to understand that what they say matters and has value and expertise and insight. All those kind of things are happening in the room before we've shared it with anybody else. And what we discovered is, in terms of group work, it's an incredibly useful process because it shortcuts so much time. Having a testimony and taking it to another example of that group and saying, this is what someone like you or us, depending on who that group is, have said about the situation we're dealing with, and then playing the verbatim, is creatively electrifying. The room's like, I agree, I disagree. That reminds me of, and suddenly everyone is kicking off talking. Sometimes the young people will perform testimonies of social workers or foster carers or adults who had a care experience like myself. I'm care experience. There's loads of work going on in the head of the performer, for the audience, in the space between. That is completely predicated around listening. It really makes listening a big deal. When we started, we thought what happens if we offer the young people a voice? What will they say? And within 10 minutes of being with the young people, we're like, we don't need to give them a voice. They've got a voice. It's just no one's listening. Or no one's listening in a way that makes them feel like they're being listened to. So as a practice, it's great. Also, it means that we can bring the young people, in this case, care experience young people, into the room on their own terms. They've chosen the elements that are going to be performed. And often they've decided who's going to say it. We have a testimony from a young woman who was, she was 14 at the time. And it's brilliant. Talking about what it's like to be in care and how dehumanizing it is. In essence, what you discover from hearing the testimony is she spent a long time waiting for the opportunity to say this. And no one's ever asked her to say it. So then when she says it, and it's really clear and focused and together, it's massive. And then she was a young white woman from the East End of London. And when we did it initially, she said to me, will you do it? And I was like, yeah, but why? Because it's going to be really weird hearing you say, I'm a young girl from Essex, a young white girl from Essex. And I want the audience to play with that. I'm like, you're a genius. It's brilliant. Yes. So I did it. And obviously, I don't present that way. So it means that the audience are confronted with the fact that they aren't absolutely listening to something coming out of my mouth, which is not my words. And that changes the resonance of it. Some people think that makes it really performative. Some people think it makes it really authentic. It's the same testimony, so I don't know where I sit on that. But the young people love the process of us going, what you're hearing is in here, but what's in here is the voices of loads of people. And then having the theatre of putting your headphones on, finding it, sometimes it doesn't work first time, all of that, and then sharing the testimony. And that, we show all of those workings to the audience, and the audience are often invited professionals who have some other relationship as adults to the care system so that they can become part of the debate. And that's how it works. My favorite experience of it is a young person who gave a testimony but didn't want to perform, but obviously was present when their testimony was shared. And my feeling of the young person was they are one of the greatest orators I'd ever met. But the thing is, the tragedy is they don't know that. And what was really interesting is watching them react to an audience responding to their verbatim testimony, because it was amazing. It is amazing. And again, we didn't make very much of it. There was none of it in the show, but it was just really interesting. In the after show party, we were like, what was it like to hear your testimony shared? And they were like, it was all right, which I thought was huge. What was it like when you saw the reaction of the audience? Yeah, I wasn't expecting that. Yeah. And so, you know, something was happening. I could see the young person going, maybe I do know a thing or two. Maybe I am worth listening to. And it's not in that mechanistic way, but it was there.
Wow, that is such a nice example. Particularly interesting for me to hear about an example from outside of my discipline in an art form that I'm not so familiar with. And the next thing that I was going to ask about is a bit more of the nitty-gritty of that. So how do you set up these situations with young people, and how do you go about negotiating some common aims for the projects? Where does that negotiation happen? Is that part of the artistic practice? Is that through certain exercises that you suggest?
Great question. I think worst case scenario, there isn't negotiation and they are not shared aims. They are aims that might be endowed upon you as the artist going in to work with the participatory group, whomsoever they are. You're in this imagined place with a commissioner, and they are, again, probably because of a wider funding ecology, they are being put under pressure to do stuff which is seemingly democratic and might be co-produced or collaborative or whatever, and you haven't met the participants. Classically, years ago, was in a project with a local authority that wanted to consult with young people around amenities. And the consultation with young people was brilliant. They were there, they were engaged, they were prepared to share their opinions. But because they'd done it before, the first thing they said was, okay, but before we sign up to this, what happens if, when we've got up to the point of telling you what we think, if you don't like what we think? And the counsellors didn't know what to do. They were consulting on a design for a library, and this really articulate young person, why would they not be articulate, but this really articulate young person said, what happens if we do research with other young people and they decide with us that we don't need a library here, but we need a skate park? What are you going to do? And the council officials had no answer. And because they had no answer, the young people went, do you know what, I'll pass then, that's a hard pass from me. Because they'd been in so many situations where what had happened is a constrained consultation process, they'd given their opinions, that information had then gone into the system, the time lag had ensued because of bureaucratic structures. So by the time the feedback from those opinions had come back to the community, the people who'd given opinions were 2 or 3 or 4 years older, and the issues were no longer relevant. So they said they didn't want to be in that situation, so they'd rather not do this. And I think that's rare, brave and rare. Most of the time, I think it comes back to what I was saying about the how genuinely are you with whoever you're working with traveling up that ladder of participation? How genuinely are they being offered agency and autonomy? Most of the time, not. And or, as a practitioner going in, your starting point is completely different to theirs. The wheels come off when the parameters of the so-called partnership are unbalanced from or unequal from the beginning, because you have more power, because you are the artist. Or, yeah, you know, if the output is supposed to be a high quality theatrical performance, theoretically, with my experience, I should be more versed in that. And therefore, I cannot be in a position of equality with a group of people who've never made theatre. They may have seen loads, but never made any. It's difficult for us to collaborate as equals. Doesn't mean we can't collaborate, but it might change my role. And I'm fine with that. But I think it's ethical for me to share that with them and say, look, we can't do this as equals because I have a complete different grounding, background, experience, exposure to this.
That seems really important, that transparency around like what outcomes are expected, the agendas of the project. But that can also feel difficult when you're working with an institution or a funder, and you know, institutions are made up of people who have a strong desire to work in that way, but there just aren't the resources available. And I also think that these terms are just becoming buzzwords. And I think listening is becoming a buzzword too, which is one of the motivators for my research. I really wanted to poke at this and to say, if listening is so important, where is it? How are you doing it? How have you made space for this?
One of the biggest benefits is one of the biggest challenges of socially engaged arts practice. If done well, it has the capacity to do all sorts of things. It can be therapeutic, it can be empowering, it can be educative, it can be all of those things that people have been talking about since applied theatre became a term. However, now that people know that, people are working in a sort of social turn to the arts, if they forget that the practice itself is at its core an aesthetic practice, and what they want is the mechanistic outcome that it can engender, the chances of it engendering that outcome evaporate. We want you to create a reflective space. Well, I can do that, but I can't just do that. I have to do lots of other things, and then the reflective space will emerge amongst loads of other spaces for the participants. But if you're just demanding that they start thinking, there's a great chance that this is going to fail, because it's just, that's not how it works. I should say at the outset that sort of collaboration, co-design, partnership are at the core of my practice. However, the worst question you can, or statement you can make with a group of young people when you walk into a room is like, what do you want to do? Because they may not yet have been in a position to have had that kind of agency, and therefore to be able to go, we know what we want to do. So it might be, this is slightly off topic, but it might be more of a conversation about, we could do this, 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 or this, or this. What do you want to do? And then they'll tell us what they don't want to do. And that's when the co-direction, partnership, collaboration starts. Actually, in research that I'm doing, which is working with a group of scientists and medical statisticians and others, because everything has to have a name, we are calling what we do, which is working with young people who are neurodiverse, as researchers rather than the subject as research, we're calling that approach co-intentional practice, because drawing from the Freire, it's predicated around the idea that everybody is aligned around the outcome. So issues of power and status and mastery are no longer relevant because everyone is already oriented to be researchers in this case. So the fact that you might be an academic researcher versus a researcher by experiential expertise is irrelevant. But to get to that point means that there's a devising process where at some point you might be consulted. In other points, you might be participating. In other points, you might be devising, co-devising. At other points, you might just be collaborating, so that the young people we're working with have an honest relationship with us.
Ways of Listening is a series for Meanwhile in an Abandoned Warehouse, a podcast about cultural democracy in community art. Show notes with links to the projects discussed are available at meow.net. This episode was recorded and produced by Hannah Kemp-Welsh.